Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought in answers you were giving just prior to the lunch and the dinner, you were placing some weight on the provisions in the consent from Hence and Planning Trustee that provided there were no buildings, etc., on lots 5 and 6.
Well, it's what the petition notes.
Okay.
So I might be reading the petition based on the cost of that petition, but that's my understanding.
Okay. That prohibition is dealt with by way of a consent notice. Then you understand, presumably, from the work we've been doing in this district, that in the rural zone, pretty much everything is a discretionary activity. And to alter a consent notice is also a discretionary activity. Does that actually create any particular protection for those lots? That combination of circumstances?
Well,
yes, but as a landscape architect, you said, well, this piece of landscape is protected by this provision, and even from the way the law is, it's not protected any more than anywhere else in the rural zone. That's what led me to ask the question in that way.
I assume that would be an understanding of program that's developed will be just from there as what's being proposed. But my understanding based on the involvement of the previous decision was the current status for that. And that's where I'm coming from in the regard.
I just have one more thing, because I asked Dr. Reed, I could ask you the same question. And it's the significance of pylons. But there was dismissive of it and really any sort of cultural significance at all. And really, I think their attitude was, well, they're here, we just have to put up with them. But they charge through them, no one else everywhere else, so I'm not going to make an exception here. I think. And certainly, the one that I'm always present is the same power line going across the face of more than the northern Perryville, presumably right through that island, and it's there, and she's right. I mean, could you have some reliance on
that in combination with other aspects that are clearly evident in the landscape? I mean, and I think to place waste on one thing would be relatively incorrect. And, you know, I think partly where I'm coming from is the scale of those, the scale of the immediate landscape is relatively small in comparison to much larger landscapes that can accommodate quite large towers and infrastructure. And one of my, having involved with the Marlborough Environment Plan that's currently going to go through its submission process. And for example, there's a transmission line running through the whole of Molesworth. And that is completely an ONL with a transmission line there. And, you know, but we're talking about the scale of landscape here where that can be assimilated as a very small feature. This is almost a feature where the main observation is from, say, Highway 6 and immediate vicinity looking towards it, where those pylons are reasonably prominent to some degree in that relatively smaller landscape. So I think that in combination with other modifications certainly contribute to the cultural interventions that are quite readily apparent in the area, especially the presence of vegetation.
Thank you.
When and how many now are development, what is the best way to do this in space?
Well, it depends on the context, and a lot really, and it
depends you might say, yeah.
on a whole range of things, including value and the characteristics and quality that underpin why something is outstanding. And I'm aware in the Queensland context, you've got a very abrupt stop to the hour now and then start to the building period. And that, in many ways, is a product of the landscape being determined some after development has occurred. So there's no right or wrong answer in that regard. And I think in this situation, where there is it's not a defined stop-start scenario, and it's probably a more a softer transition between the landscape which is outstanding and the landscape which is not outstanding, as we've determined there's no clear line where this would be. There are parts of Queenstown where there's no great planning and urban zoning, and the ONL line is sort of nicely married up together. And that works, and that could work in this situation where there is no clear definition. But what I'm coming from is a landscape, pure landscape methodology, in the landscape that indicate where a potential demarcation between those two areas could be, and that's what I've identified as the water race. But that's not necessarily saying that there are other areas, and clearly when you weigh up the cultural interventions, that's where I, in my opinion, Dr. Reed's suggestion of the Tower of the Hill really doesn't sort of stack up for that, because of those
I'm just going to look at the thoughts around Queenstown Health. The only thing is being pushed away, because I think there is no clear line being applied. You know, so even the development, okay, we'll allow some more development, but a bit more after you know now. So, how does that matter over time?
Well, I think incremental development does, on a cumulative way, the value. And I think that's fundamentally the key point of why an ONL has been demarcated in the first place, is to activate good land husbandry of that area. And Queenstown's quite different from other parts of the country, where you do have quite a hard balance or hard distinction between an ONL and development. But from a landscape perspective, you know, there's quite a distinctive change in characteristics, but not necessarily just from a land use perspective, but of course there are other parameters for the landscape categorisation and demarcation which could do a morphological aspect that also needs to be taken into account. So land use is really just one of those indications.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. My first question can be excused because he doesn't speak enough. Rather say at the end, I'd just like to come back and if I can that last question on that effect end. There's a nice submission, unless my memory is correct, I don't believe there's any footprint of the landscape boundary around Queenstown Hill or anywhere else. Which partly goes back to our compromise suggestion, shifting that line down to the urban growth boundary line. As a matter of, in the current district plan, and because of the way C1899 developed, we ended up with an ONL line at an urban boundary design, urban boundary ONL boundary. Identical from Sunshine Bay, right around Queenstown Hill, right along one side of Frankton Arm, and then on the far side of Frankton Arm, right along the far side, and round to the end of Calvert Heights. We have ONL coming down to the urban side. Now, that happened because the urban sites were there beforehand. Court said, well, the The other yellow line is the urban side line. So right around Queenstown and Franklin Place, and the Franklin Island, except for Franklin Place, the Arundel boundary and the urban boundary are contiguous. What that does, in my submission, is create a very powerful barrier. Because if you try and breach that barrier, you have to deal with a factual situation that the character of the landscape on either side of the boundary is fundamentally different. So if you go down to the zone boundary, Arundel boundary, you have Arundel characteristics. Immediately you cross the Arundel boundary / zone boundary, here is an urban zone land. So your house has a right. So you have two fundamentally different characters adjoining each other. And despite the fact that all the way around the river I've described, all those boundaries are cadastral, because all the zones are cadastral. And not any wavy contour boundaries around it, they're all cadastral, because they're all based on historic zones. And to the best of my knowledge, the only time that rock hard O&L urban boundary has been breached in 20 years, my trading days, from Queenstown Hill. Somebody's tried twice in Sunshine Bay on the same spot and failed twice. I'm not even sure it's ever been challenged before. In Trident, if you really tried it, the truth of the High Court, there was a completely anomalous boundary within one little space. There were two houses, I think, that were over the boundary, and two empty sections. There was a little bit where the boundary was fundamentally wrong. Somebody's got a man's sake. And he succeeded at the council level and the environmental court, now he failed the council. The environmental court accepted that funny little bit was actually part of the urban landscape. If you looked at it, a couple of houses, a couple of things like that, it looked like part of the urban landscape. And then the High Court overruled that and said, it's got to be an RRL. But what you have is, because of those two fundamental characters, O and L coming down to urban, it's a very, very hard boundary to break. And that led to some of the thinking behind, if I can expand it on my attachment X, where in my opening submissions, I said, we believe the O and L boundary is copied along the pink line, or the water in terms of the pure landscape analysis. But for planning reasons, not landscape reasons, suggest you may want to shift it down to the urban grade boundary. Because my concern I thought I'd expressed was that if the O&L boundary is along the water race, although I was slightly back issued by Commissioner Mountford's comment about, well, if the O&L line is there, you're allowed to develop under there. You're not necessarily, because there'd be a gap between the O&L line and the zone. But my concern was that, having consented the Hanson Lot 4 Lot subdivision, if the O&L line is above that subdivision and the zone line is below that subdivision, you would have a gap of rural landscape that's not O&L, and I could mount an argument following on from Commissioner Nugent's point that, well, restriction, the consent of restriction is just discretionary. You're entitled to discretionary application. The O&L line is higher, the zone line is lower, there's this funny patch in between, there are four houses already, therefore why don't we do four more? We were concerned to prevent that possibility and take the development restriction in that consent, which might be open to challenge under that circumstance, and really cement the protection and remove the challenge by suggesting that if you bring the boundary down to the cadastral boundary, then, and if the zone boundary is also there, if you have the zone boundary, the cadastral boundary, and the urban growth boundary, all on the same line, it would be a hard enough battle to consent some houses up there anyway. I walked over it, it's quite different from where the four houses were. But if you had the O&L boundary, the zone boundary, the cadastral, and the urban growth boundary all on the same line, my submission would create a barrier that would be if you tried to get houses above that barrier, you'd have to get past the RL objectives and policies. You'd have to get past the urban growth objectives and policies. And it would be a very, very difficult argument. So it was a planning sort of suggestion to bring the boundary down to where it happens to coincide with the Roman court's previous boundary, just about. So there's two things happening there. It was definitely a planning argument and a landscape argument. So they tried to take these landscape lines and say, well, if you shift it down and lock it in, then you end up with a barrier that's very hard to break. And funnily enough, you end up with a vascular boundary which is consistent with virtually the whole of the LML line around Queenstown, Sunshine Bay, Third Hill, Frankton and Kilmarnock. It's all vascular. And it all gets locked in because of that difference in character.
And would the scenario where the RML boundary is the waterway and it remains rural land all the way to the urban growth boundary, that would become rural landscape character or rural character?
It would be a band of...
By default.
By default. It would be a band of rural character by default.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to clarify that. Map there, did you say that was on C180 by 99, or was it a different?
That's a photocopy of part of my appendix to C180 by 99. I photocopied that central piece.
The reason I ask is because I've got a copy here of C180 by 99, and the map attached to that seems to have different lines on it.
No!
Including in this area, no lines.
Well, that there, if you look at the bottom, the stamp with the environment court stamp,
yes,
it's appendix 2.
And what's that
about? Well, I have the original copy of what I had. I was senior counsel. I've got the original copy of the decision I received.
Mm.
I hold. That's the appendix still attached to my copy.
Yeah, and it may just be poor photocopying because the handwriting isn't the same and everything. But the, this is just the black and white thing. You're welcome to come here as well.
It's
the same thing to see with the environment court. But when you magnified, and it may just be that when they photocopy it, the lines doesn't all show, but you see it's got that piece of line there, which is this piece, these things in there. Yeah. And there's one line, not even a dotted line, but there's a dotted line here. Yeah.
Well, I can say so.
Yeah.
Here's the court stamp. Here's the hand, there's the appendix to. And that's my copy.
Yes.
And I photocopied that.
Yes.
Thank you.
settled in, if you perhaps introduce yourself and then commence reading this on 8 and paragraph 4.
Hello again. So just picking up at paragraph 4. In the last part, my evidence in chief focused on the anticipated outcomes of traffic generated by the proposed rezoning on the performance of the State Highway 6 Hawthorne Drive roundabout. This analysis was based on the assumption of a fourth leg being added to the existing three-leg roundabout, with the fourth leg serving as the Mrs. Lamp. My analysis used the design year of 2025 and the baseline traffic volumes accounted from the council's transportation model, which takes into account changes in land use zoning and associated traffic growth up to that year. I then carried out a series of modelling runs using the computer software program Consider Intersection to determine the point at which the delays at the roundabout would change to level of service E on any approach, that is, a delay of more than 50 seconds on any approach, being the point at which the roundabout could be considered to be over capacity. However, there's no guidance in any document as to the point at which the level of efficiency of an intersection becomes unacceptable, or whether it should apply to an approach or to the intersection as a whole, rather than to an individual turning movement. Consequently, I adopted a conservative assessment of identifying the point at which one turning movement on one approach has such a delay. And based on this assessment, I concluded that the submitter's land could generate a total of 1,430 vehicle movements two-way in the peak hours before the threshold was reached. This equates to a traffic generation of 55 vehicle movements per hectare, then dividing the total number of vehicle movements by the size of the submitted site. I identified that there could be additional capacity added to the roundabout if necessary at this point, in order to provide additional capacity. This could include auxiliary turning lanes or an additional circulating lane. In her rebuttal statement, Ms. Banks considered that a higher level of service should be achieved at the roundabout. And just to deviate slightly, one of the problems that arises with level of service is if you say higher or lower, it isn't clear which way on the spectrum that you're going. Mm-hmm. And so I clarified that I'm assuming Ms. Banks means a better level of service than the level of service that I'm pretty certain she does. But yeah, that's just something to bear in mind when we talk about that a little bit later on. So if it was to perform a level of service D for a significant time, Banks thinks it would be a poor outcome, since there would be up to 50 seconds of delay per vehicle. So she suggests that the roundabout should perform a level of service C, although it's not clear whether she's referring to one turning movement having this delay, one approach or the roundabout as a whole. In respect to the scenario presented in my evidence, is not one where every vehicle experiences a level of service E. The traffic generation I've calculated applies only to one turning movement in the weekday peak hour. Table 2 of my evidence shows that in the morning peak hour, the delays for vehicles ranges from 3.6 to 16.5 seconds on every approach. And that equates to level of service A and B. Even in the evening peak hour, the delays are typically below 20 seconds per vehicle. I further reviewed my modelling, which is summarised in Table 3 of my evidence sheet, and note that in the evening peak hour, and with the submitted site generating 1,430 vehicle movements two-way, 54% of vehicles passing through the intersection had delays of less than 25 seconds per vehicle. For the roundabout as a whole, the average delay per vehicle is 33 seconds and level of service C is provided. To clarify my comment in paragraph 32 of my evidence sheet, which has been queried by Ms. Banks, the modelling which I've carried out makes use of the likely geometry of the roundabout, based on the current geometry of the roundabout. My comment was intended to convey that I've not suggested any factors that could result in the roundabout having greater capacity, such as gap acceptance values, and my view is that it provides a conservative assessment. In fact, considers that a 25% reduction in traffic generation associated with people living and working in the same location is probably excessive, but doesn't set out any alternative proportion. In fact, this is a more complex issue than it might at first seem. There will be trips that will take place only internal to the site, that's people living and working in the same area, but there will also be trips that are presently made on the highway which divert into the site. So, for example, a person living in Charlotte Country and travelling to Queenstown might instead find employment within the site. there will still be people that live in the sites and work in, say, Queenstown, that would otherwise have lived elsewhere, and so their travel would have taken place at other locations on the network. There will also be an effect on trip generation rates due to people choosing alternative transport modes. In view of the proximity to public transport and off-road cycle routes, I expect that these will be viable modes of travel. The reduction that I applied was intended to be a proxy to take into account these factors, as well as determining the exact proportions of modal share and changes in travel patterns are extremely difficult and requires complex modelling software. In view of the conservative approach that we have adopted in respect of determining the appropriate threshold for development, I remain of the view that a 25% reduction is appropriate. Mr. Pope notes that my analysis does not consider how other modes of transport will be accommodated, and this is correct because the scope of my evidence was limited to determine the extent of traffic-related adverse effects arising at, say, Highway 6 Hawthorne Drive roundabout. However, in common with other rezonings, I acknowledge that there will need to be master planning work undertaken to facilitate car by non-car modes of transport. That said, provisions already in place at the State Highway 6 Hawthorne Drive roundabout, where NZTA has already provided formal crossing places for pedestrians and cyclists. Mr. Sizemore sets out that in a high-growth environment such as Queenstown, he considers that a 30-year horizon would be more robust than a 10-year horizon, which I've used. Over this period, he notes that growth on the highway would be in the order of 31.8%, that's his figure of 22,000 vehicles a day, increasing to 29,000 vehicles. Any planning period within a decade needs to be approached with caution because there is necessarily an increasingly significant reliance on assumptions or forecasts that have a greater margin of error. The NZTA Research Report 422 of the General Transport Assessment Guidelines notes that in terms of transportation, where comprehensive transport study has been undertaken, then sufficient information on suitable guidance may be available to enable travel conditions to be predicted 20 or even 30 years ahead. But also say that it's a general premise that the furthest years in the future will produce the worst effects based on increasing traffic growth and cumulative effects. This reflects the experience where network enhancements tend to follow the traffic demands placed on that network, often with a considerable lag. In other words, it's identifying that the amendments and improvements to the intersection of that road network follow an identification of congestion rather than generally preempting. I agree with Mr. Sizemore's view that the design year becomes longer, then there's less capacity remaining at any intersection. However, in my experience, 10 years is the horizon most often used by traffic engineers, as it represents a pragmatic balance between the future year and the point at which errors and assumptions begin to skew the outcomes. Further, let the note above in my evidence in chief, I consider that I have adopted a conservative approach when assessing the effects of this period. Mr. Sizemore set out concerns with the variable nature of traffic generation at a business mixed use zone, and Ms. Banks considers that a residential zone is more appropriate. Therefore, it has taken an additional assessment of the performance of the roundabout, allowing for just residential development. This was carried out on the same basis as my earlier assessment of using 2025 traffic flows and identifying points at which any approach may change from level service D to E. My analysis shows that this point is reached when the submitted sites have a total of 1,075 houses, which equates to 41 houses per hectare. Having reviewed Ms. Banks and Mr. Sizemore's rebuttal evidence, I therefore remain with the overall views expressed in my evidence in chief and continue to support the submission of the Hanson Family Partnership and others for the rezoning of land adjacent to State Highway 6 for business mixed use zoning, subject to provisions being made to enable traffic generation of proposed activities to be assessed when they exceed the threshold level that I've recommended. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Just to present Mr. Carr, could you just refer you to the rule we were talking about earlier and the advice that you provided about calculating traffic generation rates? Table C1 of the NZTA Research Report 453, trips in park relating to land use. Can I just clarify with you, that reference for the Research Report 453, is that a particular dated report that appeared at a certain time?
Yes, it is. So NZTA every year releases a tranche of research projects to consultants. Research report 453 was an update carried out in 2011, I think, to a previous report that was produced. That was Hans von 209, which you may also be familiar with. And that the research report 453 that's referred to there, updated and set out specific trip rates for specific activities. Now, while that issue arose this morning, I had a quick look on the web, and Transfer Report 209, despite the fact it's been superseded for some particular time, is still available in the NZTA library. And so I'm confident that if that report that's referred to there was to be superseded, then it would still be available on a wide basis. But that said, these reports are only taking effect in about possibly 10 years or so. So we're looking into 2021, 2022 before I expect the next iteration of this report to come through. So it will remain available and it will remain constant for some considerable time.
And a regular report would have to
it would, yes, it would.
And you would be able to provide a copy of it to us, of that report?
To the table or to the report? The report's about that big.
Right, it is electronic.
It is electronic. You can certainly give you the reference on the web. That's not the problem. Or print versions out against all.
For the table, the table is a particular part, but we certainly need enough of the report to know that it is attached.
The
report. Yes, yeah. I think you don't need to be making it clear about that. Yes.
And the second question, Mr. Carr, using that table, one has a proposed activity of a certain kind or nature, does that table, can we use that table to identify specific trap generation rates?
Yes, so for various land use activities it sets out the peak hour of the day that the trap generation rates are expected.
Thank you. Can you answer any questions, please?
Following that from there, I think I raised a confusion, right? Are you confident that methodology they have put forward is not open to interpretation or discretion on the part of the user? And could another expert reach different conclusions by applying the same methodology and a bit of discretion?
It's always possible to reach different conclusions by applying discretion. And so, yes, there is scope and room for maneuver, I suppose. But the table itself provides three columns, one of which is a 15th percentile value, one is a 50th percentile, and one is an 85th percentile value for the trap generation per activity. The text of the report says that you apply the 50th percentile, and because the figures that are reported in the table are themselves 85th percentile values. Really complicated without getting whiteboard out. But a lot of traffic engineers can misinterpret that as applying the 85th percentile of that table, it's not the 50th percentile of that table. That said, in some circumstances, you could apply the 15th percentile in the particular type of scenarios, and sometimes you could apply the 85th percentile or the 85th percentile if you chose to do that as well. The alternative will be to take one step back. And simply rather than reference that research report, is to just pull out the figures that I have used to calculate my fees and include those within the rules. In practice, for the business mix use zone, there would only be a couple of values to actually include within the rule itself, so it wouldn't make it unduly cumbersome, but it would completely anchor it to a specific numerical value rather than having a reference to the report.
If we're using the rule to support the method of activity, I think with the restricted discretion, then there's a process by which you can anchor it out. And eventually somebody can make it finding discretion.
Well, the numbers that I've used to calculate the traffic generation per hectare, that's in my evidence in chief and in my supplementary statement, are the application of one specific figure. And so if that degree of certainty was required, then a redrafting of the rule to simply say for houses is one vehicle movement per residential unit, for commercial is 2.5 per 100 square metres, and just fixing it in that way would avoid that scenario that you should describe.
Well, maybe I could register these two things. Since we have yet to see the report itself, can we have a vote on this?
Who will vote?
No, I don't want. I don't tell you. We're all also fortunate this morning. And you were responsible for putting my mind in the first place to the different test, which would be coming from you all. And that's this issue of very long, very large areas of development with only a single point of information. Or a windy bank in particular was rather critical of your suggestion and the solutions for the middle thing case. You know, well, you're actually in opposition, but you suggested a solution to the traffic problem. The need for that new road would be just to take all routes, perfect out to like a beach road. And she's saying that's part of that traffic on going starting far on a single point of access, and with any blockage and everybody shut out, and so are the emergency services and all the internet delivery directors. So I'm getting at this Johnson Stub Road here, it's sort of the
yeah.
The handful of the other land, is it too long? And that is on the assumption that the other road does go up to Fury Hill, because otherwise they're both jump roads.
Yeah. I'm kind of reminded of the adage of the guy who's lost and stops for us the directions, and the person he asked me, I would start from here if I was you. It's not an ideal situation. It's far better to avoid cul-de-sacs, it's far better to have roads that are through routes. But inevitably, the pattern of land ownership and the pattern of land development precludes that sort of arrangement. But there are a lot of large developments that are served from single points of access. And Lefhayes Estate, until it was connected with a shot of a country with one, that has 350 houses essentially served from one access road. Jack's Point at the moment is another. That's not one point of access onto the state highway. And again, in due course, that will be linked to the Woolshed Road towards the north, but right now that's developing with one point of access.
And not what we did last week. But yes, there will be another point of access.
There will be another point of access to Woolshed Road in due course, yeah. So there are exceptions, if you like, that prove the rule. Under this circumstance, what I would be saying is that the acknowledging that having a one point of access does create constraints that wouldn't be in place with several points of access is to acknowledge those constraints from the get-go and plan accordingly for them. And so rather than having the narrowest possible road that you could put in place, ease that out such that if there is a blockage, then people can go around it. Have a wider road reserve so that the services, the utilities can be moved well through the carriageway. So if electricity company or the water company is digging up their services, then it's not affecting the traffic flows at all. So there are engineering solutions to mitigate the effect of having long cul-de-sacs or cul-de-sacs that carry out significant traffic flow. But I wouldn't describe it as being the optimal arrangement. I think it's generally accepted by traffic engineers, optimal equals through routes rather than cul-de-sacs.
Is this a circumstance where the pencil and rubber properties could be actually served by a more of a loop road, but the past probably comes back to the four views?
Yeah, there's nothing to stop. Other than topography and therefore cost and things like that, there's no constraint from a traffic engineering perspective that would prevent a loop road from being put in place.
I'm thinking it's not uncommon in district plans to find rules that limit the ability to use a cul-de-sac, and the numbers are usually down to about 12 lots or 20 lots, and it'd be quite small. But you must be talking about hundreds of lots in there.
Yes, yeah. And if there was a loop road that would be one way around it, as I said, the district as a whole has had residential subdivisions that have limited points of access simply because it's an interim or short-term measure, or it's intended that something will happen in the future.
Yeah, so this may not be such an example of
that. No, sorry, in that case, if you had the main road going from the Hawthorne Drive round up through Square Line and then a loop road off it to serve the development land towards the west, then I think that would be an acceptable outcome.
And the main road of 14 would be the, could be engineered to be the wide road that you're talking about.
Yeah. So I mean, it's a function really of the land ownership and the blockages towards the west, but I don't see that anything in here that's a complete showstopper in terms of preventing it from going ahead. It's just requiring a bit of careful thought when you get into that process.
Thank you.
Just one question about the matter of the assumption of 25% of the living and working in the area of the
chair.
Are there any benchmarks from research that's been done in New Zealand that would help calibrate that assumption?
There aren't. There's benchmarks for the amount of pass-by traffic going past the supermarket, and that has to call into retail. But in terms of this concept of living and working in the same area, it's relatively new. And in a lot of circumstances, those developments that have been consented on that basis have not necessarily developed presently to the extent that was envisaged when they were first consented. Generally what happens is pass-by traffic got higher than you would expect. I mean, for a supermarket, about 60 to 70% of that can be just driving past and calling in. So there are quite high discount factors for that. So I took a conservative approach of saying, well, let's say we've got 10% of people that are living in working there, we've got a further 10% that could tell us affected, then we've got 5% shift onto the bus, something like that to get to 25%. That said, as Mr. Dawson pointed out, the figure that I've landed on within my analysis is actually not that different to the figure that Ms. Baggett first came up with within her model and within her statements of evidence as well.
I was just thinking about, you know, the data about people who work from home, you know, and, but I don't know of anything that covers, but if I know I work in the States, where a lot of those new revenues and developments didn't get the business development that was expected, so they ended up just being coverage in the countryside, actually.
Yeah, that's where I think, bearing in mind that the lower figure that I calculated, purely residential, I think is quite important, because while I'm not so qualified to say what happens if it's not business mixed use, if it happens not to be business mixed use for some reason and then it's, and the business disappeared or became purely residential, then the figures in my supplementary statements is what that figure would be. But you only need a small amount of people who are working at home, who have a professional accountancy office on the ground floor or something like that, and you start to end up with people who are not going out of the development in the peak hours to travel to work. They travel either at different times or they see clients outside of those peak times generally to make things easy for their own travel.
Is the roundabout being only intersection that's only ever going to be there? I mean, is it going to stay a roundabout forever, or?
I think it will stay a roundabout for a considerable period of time. If I'm going to do a bit of crystal ball gazing, I think there's probably two things that might happen in the future. One of which is if we all continue to travel as we are doing, then there will need to be additional capacity there at some point, and that could easily be signalised around that, which is they're putting in the Northern Hemisphere. Or if the uptake of self-driving cars is as fast as everyone's expecting it to be, what we'll find is the road network suddenly has a lot more capacity because the cars are all talking to each other and they can follow a lot more closely. So we've got attention at the moment, I think, is where we are, and I think probably 10 years, 20 years, when we look back, this is the pivot point, if you like, that will go one way or the other.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask that is, you know, a lot of the traffic in this district is due to tourism. We had evidence yesterday from the airport company telling us that pretty much the number of visitors, the number of passengers, the airport is servicing
by 2025 will double what they have at the moment. Now, will that in itself have an effect on State Highway 6, irrespective of what happens on this land?
Yes, it will. The pressure point is obviously the roundabout straight outside the airport, which is smaller and also has two circulating lanes, just like the Hawthorne Drive roundabout, but the smaller size of it means it has less capacity. So that would be the first point to go under pressure. And then when NZTA sorts out the VP roundabout, which is imminent, the next two to feel the pressure will be Hawthorne Drive onto the Grand Road. It's hard to say, I think, whether the growth will be sustained. I was looking back a little while ago for a job which is still ongoing, where I first did a transportation assessment in 2006, and at that point there was 13% annual growth on State Highway outside of the Millennium Hotel in town. And at that point the council was requesting that all future assessments use that rate of 13% year on year growth. How things have transpired, that wasn't sustained, but nevertheless that's what they requested at the time. And I think it just shows the danger of extrapolating previous trends to go forward. But the roundabout I think will stay. I think the speed limit will reduce in due course, it drop down to 50, and that gives you extra capacity as well. And if it drops down to 50, then there becomes the opportunity for having additional intersections if there was going to be more attention to others on either side of the way to
Monaco. So there are other things that could happen that would we'll put it this way, but the situation as it is now is not the final circumstance in the rail network.
No, it's
for us to consider.
It's not, and that's the reason why I use the 2025 design, which, because the model, the transportation model, is supposed to take into account the changes in the land use, but also the changes at the airport. Now, hand on heart, I don't know what assumption is built into passenger growth at the airport within the model, but I know that there is an assumption of growth that was built into the model that was current at the time that the model was built, because I know that there were discussions between the council and the airport in that regard. So the traffic flows that I've used for 2025 do allow for growth on the highway associated with changes in activities such as that, which is why it's a more aggressive approach than simply the existing figures and adding the proposed traffic onto it.
But the management of the highway can be altered too.
Yes.
So the management of the highway is not fixed forever as it is now.
I was just saying that on that section of road going up to the lady, to the southern country roundabout, where as I said, reduced the speed limit from 100 down to 80, partly for safety reasons and partly because you can get additional capacity.
Increases capacity.
Yeah.
Okay. The only other question I had was in your evidence, were you talking about the 55 vehicle threshold per site. And you may not be the right person, maybe Mr. Ferguson, but do you envisage this as a tradable amount that could be traded between sites?
I'm not the right person to ask him.
Right.
But I simply did the calculation of the total amount of traffic and divided by the physical area of the sites to get that average value.
Yeah. Okay.
Before calling Mr. the question was put to me about paragraph 75 of my legal submission to make against me, and I pulled up that mistake and crossed out my second sentence. I've just gone back and done my calculations again and found out that I was correct the first time around. So if I could just, on page 75, paragraph 75 on page 21 of my legal submissions, reverse my position and stand by what I wrote originally.
It isn't double counting. Okay, fine. I just
point. I didn't know.
I know the plus when you asked me, but now I looked at it, I've actually gone back.
Can you actually clarify what the word net means in this?
Oh, sorry, yes. Net is the equivalent of the council's minus 32% for roads and reserves.
So that's second sentence space.
That's second sentence space, yes. 33.3 residential units per net hectare is the same as 22.6 residential units per gross hectare. Paragraph 3 is present.
Why don't you examine the most appropriate sizes for a collect period of land along the side of state holiday service? One case of them is either growth boundary or the boundary of the great effect. In my opinion, this land is a valuable land source. It's currently underutilised within the urban area, and subject to multiple and unrelated constraints, including aircraft noise, landscape values, a transpower transmission line, and it is within close proximity to state wide states. Despite these constraints, the land is a valuable part of the future urban area for Queenstown and Brandon because of its ability to gain access onto the state highway network and its proximity to existing council infrastructure. It forms a logical expansion for existing urban areas, both residential and commercial, without inappropriate sprawl or encroachment of those urban areas. By evidence and sheet, considers a range of reasonably practical zoning options for the land, and finds that the business of its use zone is the most appropriate overall at achieving the objectives of the proposed district plan, as well as part 2 of the RMA. In arriving at this view, I have considered how to best make an efficient use of the land within the notified urban growth boundary and implement the higher order strategic and urban development objectives within chapters 3 and 4, including in particular the key strategic objective of Franklin to recognise, develop, sustain and integrate the key mixed use function of Franklin. Waivers and Chiefs suggest a number of site-specific amendments to the notified business mixed use zone provisions, including to insert a new objective and attendant policies for that part of the zone fronting State Highway 6 between Hanson Road and Ferryhead Drive, to provide for a planted buffer along the State Highway 6 interface, to provide for safe and legible transport, walking and cycle connections, and to address road noise and to prevent activity sensitive to aircraft noise. In order to recognise and provide for the interface with the adjoining rural zone, I've also recommended further length of discretion for building rules so as to manage the transition between the zones and ensure greater proportions of open space and lower building heights are provided. The rebuttal evidence of Ms. Kaybanks for the council continues to oppose the business which is zoned for this land and maintains the view as advanced within the section 42A report that the land east of the EAR roundabout, that's the Drive roundabout, below the L&L and outside of the out of control boundary, be included within the high density residential zones. No changes proposed to the location of the urban growth boundary, and a further recommendation is to make a 50-metre building, a 50-metre setback, within the new area of high density residential zone from the boundary of State Highway 6. This recommendation is a significant change from the proposed district plan as notified, which was to include all the land outside of the out of control boundary and within the urban growth boundary within the medium density residential zone. The rebuttal evidence from Ms. Kaybanks raises several key issues and pointed to them that I address below. The 50 metre building setback, paragraph
5.1 of the rebuttal evidence of Ms. Kate Banks discusses the extent of the proposed 50 metre building restriction area from the boundary with the state highway, and which is recommended to apply to any urban zoning in this area. This recommendation extends back to the Section 42 report and appears to be based on consistency with the Frank Place Special Zone D and the possible future need for future open space and infrastructure provision. Why does the chief recommend a 20 metre building setback, except where elevation physically separates the land towards the eastern part of the land in State Highway 6, and where this cuts into the terrace landfall on its descent into the shot of the river bridge? The purpose of the 50 metre setback being active area A within the Franklin Place Special Zone is twofold. To create a landscape corridor, acting as a method of increasing visual amenity and sensible alignment to the destination of Queenstown, and to retain the view of the outstanding natural landscape that remains from the State Highway. I agree that the visual amenity of the State Highway 6 bridge is important within this area because of that sense of arrival, and also because, as it has been recognised already within the PC19 land, and I'm sorry, where I refer to PC19 there, I'm referring to the Great Place Special Zone D. However, the dimensions do not, in my view, need to be the same, as they are limited to the specific relationship of building height and views to the amount of natural remarkables. I consider 20 metres sufficient width. The maintenance of the visual amenity of the approach to Queenstown, which is reflective of the general design approach taken in PC19. I note that the Council has not produced any landscape evidence to support a proposed 50 metre building restriction area, and 20 metres also allows for the possible future roadway and annual installation of roads on Queenstown. The mixed-use function of the business mixed-use zone. At paragraph 5.1a, the rebuttal evidence of Ms. K. Banks acknowledges that for some modification, the provisions of the business mixed-use zone could allow for the use of land which excludes activity sensitive to aircraft noise within the out of control boundary. However, Ms. K. Banks considers that the required amendments to address that would be at odds with the purpose of the business mixed-use zone that is intended to provide a mixed-use function integrating commercial and residential uses. Delivery of the mixed-use outcomes exclusively within individual land holdings is not an outcome that I take from a review of the business mixed-use zone, but rather the zone as a whole has the flexibility or capability to enable a range of compatible mixed-use outcomes. Regardless, if there are small adaptations necessary to the design to achieve the higher level policies relating to the management of the airport and to achieve the mixed-use outcome for Brampton Flats and of the integration of activities, that is ultimately more efficient in achieving the objectives of the plan and retaining the land reserve rural. The business mixed-use zone is generally well placed to manage integrated and mixed-use outcomes, as illustrated through the objectives and the policies that seek to accommodate a variety of activities while managing the adverse effects that may occur and potential reverse sensitivity, and to require a high standard of amenity to manage compatibility issues of activities within and between development through site layout, landscaping and design measures. Land within the out-of-control boundary and the residual area of the land. At paragraph 5.21, the rebuttal evidence of Ms. K. Banks acknowledges that some type of urban use other than ATAN could be appropriate within the land affected by the out-of-control boundary. Ms. Banks relies on the Council's economic evidence and states that there is, however, no robust evidence to show there is a need to provide for additional commercial use in this location, and no certainty that the possible effects on this existing zone town centres and traffic will be appropriately managed. This statement fails to recognise that the converse is true for any zoning outcome which is applied to the land. The rural zone does not exist in a policy vacuum, and it is not a planning repository for land that does not meet fit into any other viable planning zone, as it too needs to be justified as being an appropriate option to achieve the objectives of the proposed district plan. Paragraph 7.30 assesses the status quo under the operative district plan of retaining the land as rural. I consider this option to be the least appropriate of the five options I identified from a district plan perspective, because it would not achieve any of the objectives of the project related to mixed use function of Franklin. urban growth and development, opportunities for housing or commercial growth. Moreover, it would create a greater tension than the other options with the objective to provide a compact and integrated development within the urban growth boundaries. A further aspect to consider in the context of this land is the overall integrity of returning it to rural, which will fail to integrate the surrounding land uses and, based on existing use, will clearly be unrelated to the outcomes anticipated for the zone. And how realistic is it for that zone to remain intact in the long term? The oversupply of commercial land. A key concern of Ms. K. Banks has with the business mixed use zone is with the alleged adverse effects of the oversupply of commercial land, including to undermine the viability and amenity of existing town centres. This is based on the rebuttal evidence that Mr. Osborne considers that if the cost of rezoning additional commercial land is not balanced against the benefits that are unique to the rezoning and cannot be accrued elsewhere for the purpose of rezoning, then it has the potential to cause a net cost to the community. Rebuttal evidence of Ms. K. Banks doesn't go any further to then analyse whether this land has any of the unique factors which cannot be replicated elsewhere to mitigate the net loss in economic terms to the community. The submitters have not called economic evidence in support of the proposed relief, and so I can only rely on the evidence of Mr. Osborne with respect to the economic analysis. From reviewing that evidence, however, it is my opinion that it does not provide an evidential basis that the rezoning of the land is either unnecessary or would otherwise have the adverse effects or costs on the other commercial centres which are discussed. I addressed the planning context of Mr. Osborne's analysis and whether the net economic losses he considers possible can be balanced against other benefits that would arise from the creation of the mixed-use zoning outcome, which can integrate land uses and ultimately make an efficient use of land or an efficient use of the limited supply of urban land located within the urban growth boundary. Council's economic evidence from Mr. Osborne and Mr. Heath considered there is sufficient existing capacity to meet expected demand for commercial rezoning of business land through to 2048 through vacant commercially zoned business land of approximately 72 hectares. However, within the Wakatipu Ward, vacant commercial supply of 46.9 hectares is not considered sufficient to accommodate estimated commercial land demand by 2048 to 63 hectares, resulting in an estimated shortfall of 16.1 hectares. The evidence suggests that the district is currently in an oversupply of commercial land market, but that it will be a projected shortfall over the long term. With this as a backdrop, Mr. Osborne considers that the evidence for the submitted does not establish a, quote, need for the additional rezoning. It goes on to list several potential economic costs. Importantly, the evidence of Mr. Osborne does not address or provide evidence on whether or how these potential economic costs are being incurred now, given that the oversupply market which already exists. From a policy perspective, the version of policy 3.2.1.2.3, advancement in my statement of evidence for panel on screen 1B, is to avoid additional commercial rezoning within Frankton that will fundamentally undermine the function and viability of Frankton's commercial areas, or which will undermine the increasing integration between the nodes in the area. From my understanding of the evidence of Mr. Osborne, he's not saying that the proposed business mixed use zone will fundamentally undermine the function or the viability of Frankton's commercial centres. It merely identifies potential risks or possible outcomes based on a predicted oversupply in the short to medium term, without then establishing that these risks and possible outcomes will eventuate. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. Osborne establishes a framework for qualifying the economic losses from rezoning, which may be offset by the benefits being unique to this land and that cannot be replicated elsewhere. In a planning sense, I consider that the land distinct in the way that it is situated adjacent to a significant commercial area of Frankton. An existing residential area that qualifies from the east, rural land to the north, the range of constraints, from the airport noise and landscape barriers, and already readily serviced by council infrastructure. A business mixed-use zone provides an opportunity to provide an integrated framework for the management of this land that responds to these unique factors. It is also very important to consider the range of potential land use outcomes possible on this zone, of which commercial land was part, but which are likely to also include residential developments and as a church and community activities. benefits of a business mixed use zone is it can accommodate a variety of land use outcomes. And as a planning tool, it can be more responsive to changes in markets and owners' economy. That's my summary of it. So
Ferguson, in the summary, in a couple of places, in paragraph 4 and then towards the end, paragraph 21, you referred to objectives and policies and the strategic chapters as you recommend them.
Yes, I have.
If you considered your proposals against the objectives and policies as notified, do you get to the same outcome?
The with respect to the key policy on Frankton, it's not a significant difference though. And in terms of most of the other policies that I've relied on in the strategic directions chapter, they're not significant differences. But I think I can recall the Frankton policy that was my version of the policy I think talked about whether it was significantly undermining the commercial viability of that commercial centre, whereas the policy version was promoted by the council in a way that undermined the commercial viability of the commercial centre.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that on the difference? I don't think the difference is a material difference of the application of this rezoning proposal.
So you've come to the same conclusion that you've
come to the same
conclusion.
Is it worth famous enough in Queenstown to have holes? How would it resolve? It's good road. It doesn't feel to me that it's really developed according to that zone in that area yet, is it?
No, the just right, I think it's a, it was a, the best of my knowledge, I think it's a zone that was new to propose a plan. And so there's no track record as such to see how that has worked in practice that we can point to.
So what would you anticipate? What sort of typology would you use? I know it allows, for example, for residential over commercial use. Mm. Is that a likely scenario? Or would it be more likely to be a lot of business here and a lot of residential there, side by side?
Well, I think this is part of the appeal of the zone was that we have on this particular site a range of constraints that will perhaps naturally determine where your residential typologies might be more naturally suited, and where the commercial and non-residential activities might wish to locate, and by that I would be thinking more towards that western end of the site where you've got the outer control boundary of the Queensland Airport, which I'm suggesting would prevent activities sensitive to aircraft. So that would be one potential area, for example, where there might be a more efficient use of that area to be a non-residential or a commercial land use. Again, equally, perhaps at the far eastern end, against the far rise, it would logically make sense to have an interface there that was more of a residential nature and some flexibility for the land in between.
How does the zone, I don't know, I haven't studied it at all, how do the planning community conflicts between residential and commercial?
The vision, the members of the zone in terms of the community that I'm proposing to relate to primarily assets around the outer corridor, which is the same issue really almost in the past community. But you've also got roadways, so that's the 8 metre, the internal noise insulation standards, that would be factor that would impact on amenity. And within the business mixed use zone itself, the rule, the primary rule is around the building design, where all building itself is a restricted discretionary activity. and their relationship on matters of discretion relating to groups and rights of people's finances. Those would be the main provisions of standards that would control this.
Or is it the landscaping standards?
Both in terms of the overall site coverage, percentage of land that's available outside of the built areas, but there's the specific rule around that I've proposed to be incorporated around the landscape buffer and 20 metres straight back from the state highway. Part of the rule, or the changes that I'm recommending around the building rule, also a proposal to address the space between the business and the city zone and the rural zone at the business and zone, proposing some changes to the rule that would replace the network through a lot of different heights and more open space between buildings to create those views through the developments. That's not about, not perhaps strictly related to internal density, but more about dealing with the interface with the adjoining rural zone.
We weren't aware, but just the car yesterday gave a wage injection to business mixed use only within the OCD.
That's
the point that it's only related to it. But across the water way, you're not there. And
know, more about that sort of the integration between those mixed-use activities. And I thought that there was a strong compatibility between business mixed-use zone and that high water quality period. So if it is, there is a mechanism to swim between the different from that. In terms of alternative zones, I don't see that Connecticut and Townsend that I'm aware of that had that ability to start at that point and had that compatibility from the beginning. I thought, well, the changes that would be necessary to meet the constraints that were identified are relatively minor and would leave the zone pretty much intact. But recognising the crew, you know, appropriate amendments that there would be specific and key changes required for this area. And, you know, by that I'm talking about the sort of objective policies, the rule around the S-bands and the management interface of the state highway and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I had thought it was a pretty good starting point for that reason. But equally, I wouldn't discount the possible benefits of applying the structure plan as well. I think there's some merits in that idea, particularly in terms of the road, the general road.
The other question I had was the land with the Transpower, you know, the energy site, and the west, slightly down the Hexton Road. What's happened to that land? And what do you think?
Yeah, that's...
Well, at the moment, it's not in this, in your part of the proposal, but we have to think about it.
No, and I've agreed to my bills in chief. Appendix 1 of my bills in chief, just in terms of that. By way of background, the scope of the submission that was lodged by the Hanson Family Partnership did actually seek to rezone the area of rural and medium density residential zone located over the land on the northern side of State Highway 6 between Hanson Road and the eastern access road. So, in scope terms, I think you're capable of making a decision, if you like, in terms of that submission that can apply to all of that land. In practical terms, of course, the Transpower, the designation of Transpower is the booking to this site because of the way in which it really does provide an obstacle, I think, from a practical perspective in trying to get connection through further out to the west. That's just an unfortunate circumstance, perhaps, but I certainly could see the ability to look at a consistent planning approach taken for that land on the other side of the west and the other side.
So it could be feeding in here?
Yes.
Why not? Including the Transpower site, why not?
Well, the nature of those existing uses which are there, and you've got immediately to the west of Transpower, you've got the Aurora. Also, Delta is a depot, and you've got the Aurora, because you've got substation and other substation, because you've got the Transpower one to the Aurora one, and then you've got, of course, you have the Grant. It's an industrial workshop.
Yeah,
all of which would fit neatly within the type of outcomes which are just in the business, which is the problem. I guess that's the point of what I was trying to say. My evidence certainly doesn't exhibit a broad character.
No, I got that.
Yeah. Sorry. I make the point.
In a couple of places you've referred to the noise mitigation within 80 metres of the state highway. Certainly in passing, I thought I understood you to be saying
there was a requirement that one of the constraints was that in addition to the OCB requirement. Did I not hear you correctly?
No, I think you did. There was a procedure in my provisions.
I'm just wondering where in the provisions is it? Is it suggested in your book?
It's suggested in my book.
Right. Okay, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. A provision which is not described in any way, it's just that it's picked up in elsewhere.
But that's something you're volunteering.
Yes.
Is it consistent with what NZTAS or the other zones?
My understanding is yes.
So I said that this sort of rule, I think, is fire comes to it, for instance, about tribunals.
NZTA dressed up in the first place for their own work when they were looking at compensating the adjoining landowners when they were building something.
Yes, that is part of the NZTA's residential zone. It's notified and it's modified as part of the right of the council.
Yep. So.
Yeah, I know you've got suggestions and all of the rest of it, but just as a matter of principle, when you in our seat and you look at all the different requests to amend the ONL, UGB and zone boundaries.
I'm trying to provide you a policy answer so that I don't have to come up with something that's...
I'd like one too, because
I'm not sure if you... You referred to in paragraph 7.22 of your questions.
Yes, that there is a...
I don't understand how you carry that through, so I was going to ask the same question in a different way.
Right. I'm looking at my appendix 4 of my notice sheet, and I provided a list of the objectives and policies, and on the second last page of my appendix 4, there is policy 4.2.3.7.
Yep.
And it provides a really helpful suggestion around the niches to be managed in a sense to provide a sensitive transition to rural areas. And that can mean a lot of things, what sensitive means and how that might be done. And I think you can see that from some of the earlier discussion that's been happening today that historically most of the settlements, most of the township of Queensland is now hardage in steps a function of the history and the timing of the relationship with the electrification happening after the development of the town. So that tended to create, as Mr. Goldsmith described, a hard R&L urban growth edge for the most part. And this is a reasonably interesting, unique situation. We don't have that edge at the moment. We just have rural, the state highway perhaps is that edge at the moment, and so we're needing to create that. If you look in, so I think part of the answer is to look at what is happening with the rest of the township, which is the way in which that then growth boundary and the interface with the rural zones manage. And I think if you look further to the east with the Quail Rise zone, it seems to be again, it's a reasonably hard edge. So I'm quite comfortable with that hard edge continuing to apply on this land as really has an extension of coming through from Quail Rise. And then that the transition within the building design controls so that it has something maintains the access, visual access through the open space between buildings and relation to height for the city that.
So here in Phoenix 5 in your proposed rules, do we see that transition applied?
The additions to the rules relating to buildings on my, it's para 5, it's got the standard relating to buildings, so 16.5.11.1, and at the top of the next page, the matters of discretion to rule 16.4.2. And three bullet points there of management and transition. So you can see that I'm talking about the part of the zone between the National Grid Corridor and the rural zone.
So I'm just looking at that rule. So you don't mean site as in site, do you mean the zone as applied in this area? So in the heading, you've got site frontage, that kind of stuff.
That should be the zone.
Yes.
That part of the zone, isn't it? So yes, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. So the intention is that transition is moving through those methods of description.
Yes. So that's part of the answer. Of course, as you go further east, the National Grid Corridor itself becomes closer to the eastern zone, I think.
Obviously,
that's
why
it will
become the edge. How do you see your third bullet point there, lower building heights, being achieved when it says that you can have maximum building heights of 12 metres? The matter of discretion says lower building heights, but so if I made it 11.9 metres, that would be satisfactory. I'm just being, the sort of devil's advocate.
it's a matter of discretion, which the applicants and the council is just that they need to turn their mind to. Notwithstanding that it's permitted up to 12, but on this site, on that land, that's located within the interface. I think that's saying that matter of discretion is not saying that that's an entitled height that you can achieve.
Should the maximum building height rule then exclude, for instance, 50 metres from the urban growth boundary?
Or
the rubber. I'm just wondering. I was meaning that the maximum is excluded and that it be discretionary within that area. I have been a consultant for a long time and I've acted for people getting as much as they can out of the rules. So.
it's good to pick them apart really before they go right, isn't it? It could well be that there is an acceptable height limit that could be conceived. Perhaps, and maybe at this level,
might be the ability to apply a discretion above the state, for example, a single height at a sort of level building height. So recognise that some people have developed
on that discretionary beyond the prescriptive discretion.
That's right,
beyond that.
So you might have a starting point with a single story building something under a range of 5 to 5.5 metres, still a single story building. Above which
Rather than having to think on your feet, it might be useful, I think, if you just thought that through and included that in the memory. I think it's a fair way to do that. Thank you.